And good morning, everybody. Glad you're with us this morning on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. The Pakistani author Mohsin Hamid has written three acclaimed novels. His first, Moth Spoke, was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Prize. And The Reluctant Fundamentalist, his second book, was a New York Times bestseller, was published in more than 30 languages, and shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. It was also made into a movie last year. His latest book has just been released in paperback. It's called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. It's a fantastic, trenchant look at the life of a man who journeys from indigent child to wealthy industrialist. And it's written as if it were one of those self-help, get-rich-quick books that fill the shelves of bookstores around the world. Here's Mohsin Hamid reading from the opening chapter of the novel.
This book is a self-help book. Its objective, as it says on the cover, is to show you how to get filthy rich in rising Asia. And to do that, it has to find you, huddled, shivering, on the packed earth under your mother's cot, one cold, dewy morning. Your anguish is the anguish of a boy whose chocolate has been thrown away, whose remote controls are out of batteries, whose scooter is busted, whose new sneakers have been stolen. This is all the more remarkable since you've never in your life seen any of these things.
Mohsin Hamid will be discussing How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia next Wednesday at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road in Baltimore. And this morning, he joins me on the phone from St. Louis. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm so delighted to talk to you. This book is a terrific, terrific read. Congratulations and thanks for this really great piece of writing.
Thank you very much.
Of the many things there are to admire about this book, the structure is certainly one of them. How did you come to formulate this story around the concept of a self-help book?
Well, it started as a joke. A friend of mine and I were laughing about how sometimes reading literary fiction can seem like hard work. It's like doing self-help. But the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, maybe writing novels for me really is a kind of self-help. Maybe there's something, some way in which I help myself by writing fiction. And maybe even reading novels helps the reader in some way. So what began as a joke by the end became pretty sincere.
Do you think really that it's true most of the time that reading literary fiction is hard work? I didn't find reading your book at all hard. I found it delightful and I was sad that it ended.
You know, I think it's the stereotype that reading literary fiction is hard work. Actually, of course, you're right that so much of what's written is a real pleasure to read.
You make two very interesting decisions to tell this story. The first is that none of the characters are named. We never know the protagonist's name. The love of his life is referred to throughout the book as simply the pretty girl. What do we know or not know about a character when she or he is named or not named?
Well, I think, you know, sometimes when we use names, the names bring with them a whole series of expectations. So when you use the name the United States and you set a novel in New York City, that creates certain expectations. If you set a novel in Pakistan and you use words like Islam and you name people with names that people have in Pakistan, immediately, you're in a particular political setting, you're in a kind of exotic setting. The nice thing about not using names is that everything becomes human again. Every person is what they are and how they behave instead of what their name is. Every country is what it's like to live there instead of what the newspapers tell us about the place.
That's fascinating. The other decision you make is to speak this novel in the second person. Reminded me of Jay McInerney's book from the 80s, Bright Lights, Big City. I mean, only in that way, in that it's in the second person. And you sometimes refers to the protagonist who's talking about himself, and sometimes it's a direct statement to the reader. Again, is this what do you gain and not gain by using second person instead of first person or third?
Well, I think in every novel, the reader is helping to write the novel with the writer. You know, a novel is just words on a page, but in a reader's imagination, it becomes people and images and all these things. And so I think the reader is always part writer and part character. When you use the word you, though, you're making it a bit more explicit, and you're inviting the reader to play a bigger role than perhaps is normally expected. The other thing I think about using you to blur the distance between who the character is and who the reader is that this is a form that's been used for thousands of years in a particular kind of love poetry that exists in Pakistan and other places called Sufi love poetry, which are basically love poems that talk about how you can relate to the universe, how you can relate to life and the divine, as though you are a beloved speaking to you.
My guest is Mohsin Hamid. His latest novel is called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Let me ask you to do what I'm afraid to do, and that is tell us a bit about the main character and the love of his life. I'm always afraid that I'm going to spill too many of the beans, so I'm going to let you make that decision. Can you introduce us to those two main characters, at least?
Sure. Well, right now on planet Earth, a billion people in the next 10, 15 years are going to move from the countryside to the cities of Asia and Africa and Latin America. And you, the main character, is a boy from a very poor village who moves to the big city, lives in a slum, and meets a young woman whom he will call the pretty girl for the rest of her life. And both of them set out in different ways to become rich and famous, and their lives keep intersecting. They don't really wind up necessarily together in the novel, but they stay in love in a way and keep bouncing into each other. And the novel follows the arc of their lives from childhood through old age.
So you live in Lahore, Pakistan, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that, you know, you don't name the city just as you don't name the country or the city in the novel, just as you don't name the characters. But it's assumed that it's someplace like Pakistan, perhaps. And it paints, is that an unfair assumption on my part?
Well, I use Lahore, Pakistan as my model, but interestingly enough, a Mexican team of filmmakers has optioned the book to make a movie, and when they called me to discuss doing that, the first thing they said was, this could be set in Mexico City. And when I've traveled in India or to Indonesia and Jakarta, people have said similar things, like this could be set in our city. So, in a way, I use Lahore as a model. But I was trying to say something universal about these new emerging megacities throughout, you know, the third world. And hopefully that's how the book reads.
Well, let me ask you a question that's specific to Pakistan, because you live there and you're such an important part of the literary scene there. You paint a very grim picture of this city in the novel, of a place full of graft and corruption that sort of permeates the entire economy, and this severe bifurcation of haves and have-nots. And you examine various divides, I mean, the economical divides, the rural-urban divide, the literate-illiterate divide. These same divides, as you say, you know, can define many cities and many places around the world, certainly many in America. And here in the U.S., President Obama and many others have taken up this issue of income inequality. I wonder, are there those in Pakistan who are taking up this issue as well? I mean, is there a movement to address the disparity between the very wealthy and the very poor?
Well, I think it's a bit like the U.S. You know, people talk about it a lot, but not that much is being done. And, you know, it's very difficult to address this issue, but it's a vitally important issue because, in many ways, I spent in the 1970s 6 years of my childhood in America. My father was doing his PhD here. My father's a university professor. And I remember the America of the 70s. I went to a public school as being a much more equal time in America. So you're right that Pakistan and America are sort of both heading towards, you know, greater inequality. The difference is in Pakistan, because there's so much more poverty to start, the violence and unrest that comes from that inequality is more stark in a place like Pakistan.
What's the literary scene like in Pakistan?
You know, it's pretty exciting. Just a couple of weeks ago, we held the second Lahore Literary Festival, and it was 3 days of talks about books, and there were writers from America and India and Britain and, of course, many from Pakistan. And we had 45,000 people, you know, show up just for 3 days of sitting to hear writers reading from books and talk about books. There's a real excitement, I think, particularly among young people. You know, one thing which is happening in Pakistan is the university population is exploding. There's hundreds of thousands, a million university students now in Pakistan. And these young people are reading novels, you know, with, I think, an enthusiasm that we've never seen before. So in that sense, it's really exciting, the literary world over there.
I mean, how would you generally assess the standing of literature and the arts in Pakistan? I mean, again, so many Americans, I think, get a pretty monolithic view of Pakistan and contiguous countries in that part of the world, given the violence that is taking place in so many parts of that part of the world. What's your take on how pervasive and how well recognized the literature and art scene is in Pakistan?
Well, I think it's actually quite striking when you come to a country like Pakistan, the amount of love and respect that there is for the arts. So the city of Lahore, where I live, is a city of 10 million people, and one of the most important sites in Pakistan is a place called in Lahore is called Data Sahib. The shrine of a writer who lived 1,000 years ago, and even today, thousands of people every day go to this shrine to seek, you know, cures for their ills and enlightenment. And it's like a pilgrimage site. And that ancient veneration for writers and artists very much continues today. So much so that when I go onto university campus in Pakistan, the kind of, you know, in a sense, love and respect and affection that the students have for me, just because I am a writer or an artist, is breathtaking. So despite what I think we often hear about places like Pakistan, the culture really elevates the rights and the writing and the arts very much.
You've written for publications like the New York Times and other journalistic publications quite frequently, and you wrote a really interesting piece a couple weeks ago in the Times, and you said that in the future, novelists need not abandon plot and character, but would do well to bear in mind the novel's weirdness. Novels are characterized by their intimacy, which is extreme, by their scale, which is vast, and by their form, which is linguistic and synesthetic. That's really fascinating. What do you mean by the novel's weirdness?
Well, you know, when we read a novel, it's the only time that we sit in silence for hours with two human beings' thoughts simultaneously in our head. You know, we have our own thoughts, and we have the thoughts which are communicated through the writing on the page. So really, a person who's reading a novel is, for a time being, two people. You know, you take somebody else's thoughts inside yourself. And that's a very weird, but also very exciting and fertile state to be in. And I think that's what makes the novel special. So I tend to feel that the novel shouldn't just do what TV shows are doing or what movies can do, but should do things that only novels can do, that touch the reader and that combine the reader and writer, because that's really part of what the magic of the novel is.
And your own road to becoming a novelist is interesting. You, as I said, you were here as a child in elementary school. You also attended Princeton and even Harvard Law School. And I guess you worked in the corporate world for a little bit. What were you doing in that capacity?
Well, I worked as a management consultant in New York and London for about a decade.
And what brought you to writing novels?
Well, I was writing novels the whole time. For about 20 years, I've been writing fiction now. And I never really thought I could make a living at it. And so I assumed, you know, I had to have a job and I had to work and do other things. And I'm really glad that I did, because the experience of working in New York and working in London and traveling the world on business taught me a lot. You know, I got to see the world. I got to see what it was like to earn a living, interview for a job, see people getting fired. And so I think it affects my writing, because I've had an intimate experience of being part of the workplace, which, of course, for most people, is how they spend most of their days.
The author, Mohsin Hamid, his latest novel is How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. It's published by Riverhead Books, and it's just been released in paperback. Mohsin Hamid will be appearing at the Ivy Bookshop in Baltimore on Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. You can come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning for a link to more information. Well, Mohsin Hamid, this has been a delight speaking with you. Thank you so much, and look forward to your visit here in Baltimore.
Thank you very much.
Monday morning on Maryland Morning, a look at a couple of plays in the area. J. Wynn Russick will review I and You at the Olney Theater, and I'll talk with Gavin Witt, the director of Center Stage's latest show, Twelfth Night by Shakespeare. And before we go, let me add my personal thanks to everybody who pledged in our winter membership campaign this week. All of us on the Maryland Morning team and all of us at WYPR will do whatever we can to merit your continued support. We are all so grateful to everybody who renewed their membership or became a new member of WYPR. Thanks so much. That's it for us today. Garrison Keillor is on the way with the Writer's Almanac. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.